Well, thank you so much for inviting me, John, Maureen, for organizing this, and for all of you coming. It's really an honor to be here. I've been reading about the Qatari Peace Conference for a while, so it's great to be here with everybody. I want to work with the theme about what's love got to do with it, because that's what it comes down to. That's why we're here, and that's why we're going to continue to be on this planet. So lately, I've been spending a lot of time reading about World War I, and specifically the poets of World War I, because I'm haunted by this war where the poets died in the trenches, hooded with gas masks and scribbling out their elegies. And the fields and the forest where that war took place in World War I, those fields and forests had been the inspiration for artists for centuries, for painters and for writers and composers. But now those fields in World War I were a boneyard, littered with the corpses of 10 million men. And over 25,000 miles of trenches had been dug in those idyllic fields, scarred the land. And yet, these soldier poets loved life enough to memorialize what was going on in verse. They talked about the beauty of life, the beauty of their comrades, and they talked about the waste of humanity in their poems. Their anger and the revulsion of war was born out of love. Some of you may be familiar with some of these poets, Rupert Brooke and Robert Graves, Alan Seeger, Siegfried Sassoon, and of course, Wilfred Owen are the more notable poets of that time. And England, the reason there were so many poets, England had just created its most educated generation ever, thanks to a lot of Edwardian reforms that had gone into effect mandating education. And so they took their most educated generation and they sent them off to slaughter. And so many of them died in the trenches. Some of them survived. But if love could survive in that boneyard of 10 million corpses, it is indeed a force more powerful. So it can conquer what we're up against today. In 1922, the poet T.S. Eliot wrote The Wasteland, and it's probably the most famous poem of the 20th century. And when he was talking about the wasteland, he was referring to those war-torn fields of World War I. And he begins that poem with the famous line that we all know, April was the cruelest month. And he says that because Eliot feared that nothing would ever again grow on that land. He thought that we had killed the land and that April's unfulfilled promise, when it comes around every spring and promises regrowth and regeneration, would not be met, and it would remind us of what we had done. And so, therefore, it would be the cruelest month. Better that we be covered in forgetful snow, he wrote. So we killed the land then, just as we're killing the land now. And, you know, I turn to poets because war is just so incomprehensible to me. And the artists, they help me to understand it. The history books don't really do it for me at times. Because when I read about all the mechanized killing of civilians, the burning of the land, the destruction of hospitals and schools, I need help from others to try to figure this out and why this happens. And the artists, they not only render this back to us in a transformative way, but they tell us that we're not alone in seeing what we see, because they see it too. And this is really important for us. We're not crazy. We're not crazy when we're outraged at what we see in the world, the suffering in the world. We're not crazy when we see so many other people going about their daily chores, seemingly oblivious to what's going on. It's not fine. This community here and so many like them affirm our sanity, and that's why it's important for us to be in community. We've talked about that last night and even this morning. These communities are really important because we need to look into each other's eyes and affirm our sanity and the rightness of what we are doing. And when we go home, even if it's just a team of two, a community of two, we need to do that because when we're alone, it's easy to get disheartened. But when we're together, we can do what the poets do. We can affirm our sanity. So weapons are the antithesis of love. They're not going to save us from war, and they're not going to save the planet. And diplomacy, without humanity, without the force of love, cannot save us, since that is mere words on paper. And even international laws will be disregarded in war, as we can see in Gaza and Ukraine, unless there's a force greater than punishment obligating the parties to abide by them. And so underlying all of that has to be the cultivation of a shared humanity. That needs to be the educational part of today, the component of today. We have to educate ourselves toward our better angels, toward that beloved community that Dr. King spoke about. And I don't think this is naive or idealistic or fanciful to talk about. It's practical, it's possible, and it's necessary. A curriculum at home and at schools for a culture of compassion, as opposed to creating a culture of militarism. And when we talk about love and how that can save us, the kind of love we're talking about is based on the respect that a living thing, a thing pulsating with life, was not and cannot be created by human hands. It lives by the force of something else. And it's the same something else that created us. And so we have no right to kill it. We have no right to extinguish it, whether it be people or the planet. So part of this process of education has to come with the stories that we tell ourselves. And I think that we as Americans need to change the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and what we are. We have a certain idea that we're the shining city on the hill and that we're always right in our foreign policy and that we're coming to the aid of so many others. This is sort of a narrative that goes hand in glove with the narrative of militarism. But we live by the stories that we always have as people, whether they be poems, you know, or whether they be plays, whether they be novels. But we tell ourselves stories to help us identify who we are. And if we can change the stories that we tell by acknowledging our past, we can make a better future. And acknowledging the past means coming to terms with what we've done in the past. And therefore, those stories can be empowering. They're not going to take us down. They're not going to weaken us. They're going to lift us up. You know, I'll go back to the poets of World War I. They were telling stories, too, these poets, when they were in the trenches. And some of those poets didn't live long enough in that war to be repulsed by what they had seen. So some of the poets, like Rupert Brooke and Alan Seeger, were writing poems that were glorifying war. You know the poem, "I Have a Rendezvous with Death" by Alan Seeger? "I have a rendezvous with death at some barricade, and I will not fail that rendezvous." So this was a guy that was really hyped on the glorification of war. And the first chance he got to go over the top and run into battle, he was machine gunned to death. He was killed. Same was true with Rupert Brooke, who was considered the most talented and the most handsome young man in all of England. An extraordinary, talented individual who was killed very early by the war. Some of those poets lived long enough to be repulsed by the war, like Wilfred Owen, who of course wrote, "If you would see what I see in war, you would never again tell the old lie, dulce et decorum est," which is that it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. So that's changing the stories that we tell, right? That's going from a glorification to a realism about what war is and what we should be doing. So as we drill down to the facts and the stories we need to tell, just let me go over a couple facts here. According to ICANN, in 2023, the 9 nuclear-armed states spent a combined total of $91 billion on their nuclear arsenal. That's equivalent to $2,898 a second. ICANN's latest report shows $10 billion more was spent on nuclear weapons in 2023 than in 2022. And of course, the United States' total share of nuclear spending, $51 billion, is more than all the other nuclear-armed countries put together. And the average daily operating cost for a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier is $6 million a day. $6 million a day. So adding to this waste of resources, the U.S. military is the greatest institutional polluter in the world, belching out more emissions than industrialized nations like Portugal or Denmark. The U.S. military buys 270,000 barrels of oil a day. That's 100 million barrels a year. So we're talking about this connection between climate and war and militarism. Here it is, with the facts, with the numbers. According to NOAA, July 2024 was the warmest July on record in its entire 175-year record-keeping. Species are going extinct at an alarming rate, and we're creating massive numbers of both war and climate refugees. Drought, fire, flood, and famine are now the norm. And this is this interlocking of war and death, death of the people, death of the planet. This is the creation of T.S. Eliot's Wasteland that he was writing about. That was 100 years ago he was writing about it, 1922. Here we are today dealing with it. The decision to take this nation's wealth and build doomsday devices is a culture of death that we have to relentlessly resist every moment of every day. We can't have our fellow citizens worshiping the bomb or worshiping our military or worshiping our weapons thinking that they're going to keep us safe, because they won't. And so we have to recreate nonviolent resistance for the current moment. And I spoke about this last night. How do we recreate it for the present day? Our imagination is going to have to be more powerful than corporate wealth and influence. And that's where we have the edge, because corporations don't have that. They don't have imagination. We've got the creativity and we've got the will to do this. So we're going to have to think about how do we distill the issue to its essence and gather around that and collaborate around that. We talked about Gandhi's Salt March and Phil Berrigan with the blood on the draft files. Think about how long it must have taken Phil Berrigan and his colleagues to come up with the idea of draft files and then pouring blood on them. That didn't just happen. That was a very thoughtful process that they went into. And the plowshares actions, you know, literally hammering on the nose cones of nuclear weapons to beat swords into plowshares. You know, very thoughtful, very creative, practical and symbolic actions. So those are the things that we should probably concentrate on doing today. One of the things that we did with the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal is to try to take a different approach, is to use a people's tribunal to go after U.S. weapons manufacturers. And a people's tribunal occurs when the courts and the government have been captured by the criminals. And so what's left but for the citizens to gather together and to try to hold accountable the culprits for crimes against humanity and for war crimes and for genocide? So with the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal, I worked with Kathy Kelly and Nick Modern over several years, and we gathered evidence. We worked with lawyers and investigators. We interviewed witnesses. We interviewed military analysts, retired military officers. We had lawyers working for us, and we created videos, 37 videos or approximately 30 minutes each, and they documented the fact that U.S. weapons makers have violated war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide as defined by the Rome Statute of the ICC. And we picked four weapons manufacturers just to be representative of all weapons manufacturers, and that was Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and we picked the drone maker, General Atomics, because we wanted to bring drone warfare into it. And again, this was just a way to be creative. We came up with subpoenas that we served on these corporations. Some of you participated in that serving of subpoenas because we did it across the country simultaneously on the same day. And it was a really cool thing to look out and see so many different groups in different parts of the country delivering the subpoenas, writing their names on them, going to the corporate headquarters, and trying to get in the doors. We did that in Arlington, where the four companies were located, the headquarters. Sometimes we got in the doors, sometimes we got to speak, such as at Boeing, with the director of communications. They came down to receive the subpoena, and we were able to present that to them. Other times they called the police. That was good, too. Whatever it took, you know, it gathered attention. It got in the press. The Washington Post picked it up. We served contempt citations. Some of us risked arrest. Some of us were arrested. But again, a people's tribunal is a really wonderful way to communicate a lot of information in a format that people can find comprehensible, right? Because people like legal proceedings, and when you're putting witnesses in videos and you're making legal arguments and you're showing the evidence, it can be a very effective process to get that out. And the Merchants of Death, I don't know if you know this, but we took our name from the original Merchants of Death of World War I, right? So it was discovered after World War I that U.S. business had led the U.S. into war, and Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota began congressional hearings in the 1930s. And he put witnesses on, just as we did, right? And he had disclosed all these documents, and it showed big business took us into war for profit. And people, Americans, were outraged. During the 1930s, there were tens of thousands of college students that took oaths, pledging that they would never fight in a European war. Farmers and factory workers and laborers across the country all marched together against war. And it was really moving in the right direction. These hearings were exposing folks. But what happened was big business pushed back. Senator Nye's committee got defunded. Big business started running articles in the press, pillaring Senator Nye. And they started running stories favorable to them. And then, of course, Hitler rises and the Nazis rise in Germany because of the failure of World War I. And we're back to where we started again. But what we need to do is to continue to press on because, you know, here we are 100 years later, and we seemingly did not learn the lesson, particularly from World War I, because when I was reading about World War I, it was interesting. The soldiers in the trenches of World War I, that's where they first started to talk about the concept of an endless war. And they used that phrase, endless war, because they were joking with each other how the next generation and a generation after that was going to have to continue to fight this war, because they saw there was no purpose in this war, there was no end in sight, and it was going to go on forever. They didn't realize that they were right. They were accurate. That actually happened. So again, who are these merchants of death? Very quickly, Lockheed Martin in 2023 made $64 billion. Raytheon made $40 billion. Northrop Grumman made $35 billion. General Dynamics, $33 billion. Big money for these people, and they spend a lot of money to get it. I talked last night about the 800 lobbyists they have on Capitol Hill, the $20 million they poured into the 2020 campaign cycle. They're probably double that amount this time around. And again, it works because the NDAA keeps getting higher and higher every year. I think that if most Americans knew how this whole process worked, they would be against it. They would not want their tax dollars going to increase the bottom line of shareholders and corporate entities. They would not favor war for profit. They believe that their lives are in danger and it needs to be defended, which it's not. It's for profit. It's for increasing the bottom line. So, going back to T.S. Eliot's poem, just to conclude here, in the wasteland. And this is a wonderful poem, and it's not that long. It's only 444 lines. And Eliot was hopeful in the sense that even though he thought that the land may have been killed, he thought there were enough fragments of civilization left that you could pull those fragments together and bring civilization back together. So the second to last line in that poem are the Hindu religious words, da, da, da. And each da, that da, da, da is meant to be the sound of God, the sound of thunder. And each da stands for something else. It means to give, to sympathize, and to relinquish control. So these are meant to be eternal watchwords for us all to embrace, because the very last line of that poem, does anybody know what the last line of The Wasteland is? What? Did somebody say? Shanti. Shanti. It's the Sanskrit word shanti, which means peace. It means peace which surpasses all understanding, the peace that can save us. So the peace is not going to happen on its own. As Dan Berrigan said, and as I have in my salutation on all my emails, peace is a verb. We have to make the peace. We all have to be peacemakers. We have to take a risk. If it doesn't cost us something, it's probably not worth it. We're going to have to bend the arc. And we can do that. We've done that in the past, and we can do that in the future. So I'm going to close with a quote from Phil Berrigan. And here's a shameless plug for my book, Ministry of Risk. I never leave home without it. But I think this quote really goes to the heart of what we need to do and what Phil did in his life and his witness. And it's where I got the title of the book. I found this my first day in the archives at Cornell University when I was doing the research. I pulled out this unpublished speech that Phil had given in 1973. He was at the ordination of another priest, and so Phil was giving this speech, and it was kind of him passing the torch to a new generation of Catholic priests and saying, this is what you're going to need to do. And the title of it was A Ministry of Risk and Liberation, and I thought, that's the title of the book. That's perfect. So, and this is where it comes from. A ministry of risk goes unerringly to the side of the victims, to those threatened or destroyed by greed, prejudice, and war. From the side of those victims, it teaches two simple, indispensable lessons. Number one, that we all belong in the ditch or in the breach with the victims. And number two, that until we go to the ditch or into the breach, victimizing will not cease.